The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday night Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks a lot for tuning us in, and we have a good program for you. It's a program topic that I talk about on the Space Show, and unfortunately, we don't get a chance to have many expert guests on that really know the topic, so tonight we will, and I'll tell you more about that in just a second. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call in, 1-866-687-7223. And do remember there are no call screeners, so be patient, let it ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send us email at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment on our blog, and to do that is our website, thespaceshow.com. Go to the far right to the upcoming show menu bar, and this is the first show listed, and you open that page up, which is our blog and archive page for this program tonight. And down at the bottom is where you do comments, just as if you were commenting on a blog. As soon as you hit send, I will get a copy of your question or comment, and I can integrate it into the program. But again, our toll-free number is our preferred way of your communicating with our guest. So once again, it is 1-866-687-7223. With email as the backup preferred way, drspace@thespaceshow.com. While you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, do check out our very detailed website newsletter. You'll see it center right in the upper part of our website. And not only does it describe all of our programs in detail for the week, if you scroll down, you'll see all of our programs that we have planned, and we're planning now through the end of July, and we're almost there. Can't believe how fast time flies. Do remember, everything we do is archived, so you can quickly download programs or listen right off of our website. For those of you interested in Space Show logo wear and store items, the easiest way to get there is on every one of our website pages. On the right, you'll see a picture of Pepper, my Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show. Click on that picture, and it will take you to our Cafe Press Space Show logo wear page. And then you can pick the category or what it is that you want to look for. To me, the most important item on the website is supporting the Space Show. Do remember, we are a listener-supported program. We're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And your contributions keep us on the air and allow us to have great guests like we're going to have tonight and that I will introduce to you in just a few minutes. And if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift, as we are a 501c3. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a California tax break as well. We're a public benefit corporation in California. You'll see a big Support the Space Show button around the center right of our homepage. And that tells you how to use PayPal or how to send in a contribution by check. And you'll see a huge Amazon button in the center of our homepage because Amazon has 2 excellent nonprofit participation programs where they donate a percentage of your purchase price of your item to the Space Show. And we are a registered Amazon nonprofit. So check that out as well. And if you have any questions about any of this, please let me hear from you. If you're interested in being an advisory board member of the Space Show, then when you go visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, on the left menu, you'll see Team, and then that has a drop-down menu for advisory board. read the description of the advisory board. And if you're interested in joining the group that is there and me, we'd love to have you. Just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. One more quick item. We do have sponsors. Sponsors get banner messages going across our homepage. And you can see those banners, and sponsors can change those banners whenever they want. We do have a few sponsorships still available for 2019. And also, I read messages from the sponsors on all full-length space show programs, and this is a full-length space show program. So Moonwords is the first segment sponsor. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us to help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. The Space Foundation is a first segment sponsor. They have their 35th symposium coming up. Don't miss it. It is the premier global space conference of the year. This year, it's April 8th through the 11th at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Their one-stop shopping all website is spacesymposium.org. And if you've never been to one, you need to go to at least one. It's an incredible event and one that you'll really be happy you attended. Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they are a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers on a global basis. They have incredible capabilities and technologies, and they range from under the ocean floor to outer space and cyberspace. So you definitely want to check them out. And then AIAA sponsors us. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have five conferences or forums per year. They have great networking to die for. They have an archive of reviewed papers, second to none, that you can access. You do not have to be an engineer to be a member, but you can, of course, be an engineering member. I'm a member, but not as an engineer. Check them out, attend their events, and enjoy their benefits at AIAA.org. That, listeners, brings me to our program tonight. So I'm very excited and interested in welcoming for the very first time Ian Fichtenbaum to the program. Now, his full bio is already up on the Space Show website, but he is a senior VP and the Space and Satellite Specialist at the American Industrial Acquisition Corporation, AIAC.com. This is a privately held group of industrial companies spanning over 80 locations in 24 countries. Within this group, Ian is the director and part of the ownership of Bradford Space Group, and this is a global space systems manufacturer specializing in propulsion systems, attitude and orbit control systems, space station facilities, and deep space missions. Ian has executed three acquisitions in the space industry in the last 2.5 years, starting with Bradford Engineering in 2016, ECAPS in 2017, and Deep Space Industries in 2018, something we talked about quite a bit last year on the Space Show. In his role as director, Ian oversees Bradford's many strategic and business initiatives, and his goal is to build Bradford into a space systems group of both global and interplanetary significance. There is a lot more to his bio and his experience. I would urge you to check it out on the Space Show website. We want to talk to Ian rather than my continuing to read about him. So, Ian, welcome to the Space Show. How are you tonight?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on this show.
Well, thank you. And to start out so that everybody is on the same page and we're all sort of working with the same working definition, can you give us your working definition of an acquisition of a space company? What is it you specifically mean?
Well, you know, when I talk about acquisitions, I'm talking about businesses. And you know, businesses can be of any sort. It can be of in any sector, from manufacturing to financial to communications. Businesses are all sorts of things around the world. I focus to a certain extent in manufacturing, but I also focus across the space industry. What's space industry? Well, it's pretty much anything in the value chain or supply chain that has anything to do with building spacecraft or launching spacecraft or operating spacecraft, or even some of the downstream parts of operating a spacecraft, like data services or on the other side, the ground systems and the ground infrastructure. My experience in the satellite industry actually is across all those various sectors, and because I have a certain experience or spent a lot of time with all these industries that touch on spacecraft, I would consider any of those things in the sector that I focus on, whether it intersects with manufacturing or not. Our group in particular, Bradford, does manufacturing, but I've spent a lot of time on things in all the sectors I just mentioned.
So it would seem to me that there's a lot of commercial history and revenue and sales and marketing history with the satellite industry, but not so with a lot of other industries, including deep space industry. So how do you evaluate or do due diligence on something that is so new and doesn't have the kind of history of a terrestrial merger candidate or even, you know, the CommSat industry, because you're working with so much that maybe isn't there or not verifiable or maybe I'm missing the boat?
Well, you know, when you come at businesses from a point of view of an acquisition, you're looking at what you're getting, what's in the pot. Is it revenue potential? Is it IP? Is it assets? And how does it fit into what you're doing? Now, I can speak in general. I can speak in specific. In the specific case of Deep Space Industries, there was both a long-term mission to exploit the resources of the solar system, but there was also a more short-term fact that it, you know, had products, it had assets, it had customers, it had operations that all can be evaluated, all can be viewed in the context of an acquisition. So these are things that you can look at that can create your view of what something is worth. Of course, at the end of the day, if you're doing a transaction with another party, then what, you know, all acquisitions are a transaction from one party to another. What one party is willing to do, or what both parties are willing to do, in fact, that's what a transaction is what happens. And in that case, an acquisition is not any more different than any other transaction. It just involves more steps and involves looking at a greater picture of activities.
Do you evaluate risk differently for a space business than, say, a terrestrial acquisition?
You know, the thing is, of course, in the space industry, you have some commonalities. There's the aspect of launching things into space, the technical risk, the development risk. But if you look at the wide range of activities in the space or satellite industry, you have businesses like the telecommunications industry, where the customers are solid, the revenues are solid, the customers are all from established businesses, the technology is known, the infrastructure is known. So there's areas where there's not a lot of risk On the other hand, you have businesses where there's lots of risk, all because either the market poorly defined or not well defined or well known. You have to develop the market, or there is technical risk, or there's customer risk, risks of all sorts. You evaluate all these things. The space industry is not any more different than the biotech industry or the earthly mining industry or any other more speculative industries. They all have their risks.
Okay, so what about the political aspect of it, the possibility of international regulations or regulations? Is that any different for space than, say, some of those risky Earth-based businesses that you just mentioned?
It's different in the particulars. In some cases, the regulations are less well-defined in space than it is in other industries. There are certain cases where the risk is not regulatory, but you have to go through a government process, a non-regulatory process. It's different, but it's not unusually different. Regulatory risks can bite you in the rear in all industries, and I think the only reason why some people will stay out of doing acquisitions or deals or investments in the space industry is just lack of familiarity. But I think if somebody can be comfortable in the biotech industry or the mining and the oil and gas industries or the healthcare industries or the all these risky non-space industries that have a great deal of regulations, you can get yourself comfortable in the space industry. You just have to spend the time and the energy. I think most of the reasons why most people haven't spent the time in the industries because most of the industries I just mentioned have been much bigger than the space industry. So there's more activity, there's more economic value to be discovered or exploited, and so in comparison to all those industries, the people who are doing acquisitions or investments or other things in the space industry are comparatively smaller.
Are there opportunities? Are they rare in the space industry outside of satellite and telecommunications? Are more and more opportunities opening up? How do you see opportunities and how far do they have to be beyond, say, the entrepreneurial startup? Because, boy, do I talk to a lot of entrepreneurial startups in the space industry, but I don't know that they're ready for prime time acquisitions, or most of them aren't, at least in my opinion. So what do they have to go through to evolve to being a good candidate for investment opportunity?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the best one to answer that. There's a lot of companies out there who are involved in either space industry or connected to the space industry. Not all of them are entrepreneurial. Some have been around for quite a long time. Bradford itself, which we acquired in 2016, had been around since 1984. Some have been parts of larger companies. They weren't even started on their own. They were an internal activity of a larger group. And that was ECAPS, in fact. That got started around 2000. That was interesting for its own reasons. But there are lots of activities, that exist. Either they supply the current industry as it exists, the current satellite or spacecraft base, or they're current satellite operators, or they're new, but they've gotten a lot of they've done a lot of interesting things, built some interesting products, and for some reason or another, if you're an acquirer and you see it and you want to have it, you're an acquirer. Or you don't have to be an acquirer. Acquirers, your designation that you have when you see the things you want to acquire and you do it. You don't. It's almost kind of a profession that is not open to. It's not closed to people who have to be go through qualification to do it. You just have to be able to see the opportunity and execute. And have the resources if it so requires, or access to the resources.
You have an email from listener Jack in Denver, and he said there have been a few well-known, rather large startup space failures. Do you get interested in buying out a failed company? X-Corp, for example, comes to mind.
Well, I think maybe I should step back and talk a little bit about our group and how it does what it does and how it put together what it's put together. So maybe I'll take a bit of a wider view. So
okay,
I work for a group called which you described at the beginning of your call of the show. Excuse me. The American Industrial Acquisition Corporation, or AIAC. Now, AIAC is actually kind of a strange animal. It's very different from a lot of company buyers out there. We're not a private equity firm. We actually don't have outside investors. We're not a large corporation like a Boeing or a Lockheed or a Ball or whoever. We're not a publicly traded company. We're a privately held group. And we're a privately held group that actually was actually assembled piece by piece by piece over the course of the last 22 years. I can't claim credit for most of it. Actually, the chairman of a group started it. It was based on the premise that there were parts of companies out there, parts of big companies, that for various reasons were either not doing well or not a fit for their parent company, or there was some issue with it. It could be environmental, it could be labor issue, it could be debts, could be losing money, could be a bunch of other, actually, a lot of reasons. And, this group has been built on the premise that it's worth betting on some of these kind of companies. It's worth going and acquiring some company that's in trouble because if you have the skills and if you have the intelligence and the, or maybe even the foresight to see what a company can be, then it can become something very interesting. So this has actually been one of the ways that AIAC has grown, and today it is over 80 manufacturing locations in 24 countries. Bradford is the space part of that. And I can't deny that we look at it, some of the things that way, but you know, we have a broad view of what we acquire. So something that's in some trouble, something that's in that's in need of a new ownership, something that's in need of somebody who can carry on the mission or just continue to develop the company, it is actually something that we do a lot. And if you do it, it's a skill in and of itself. There are interesting things in the space industry that could be interesting to the right owner, somebody with interesting technologies, somebody with a platform that could compete in suborbital or launch or just manufacturing or propulsion systems. X-Corps, just speaking specifically, and I don't want to get into it too much, but I actually knew them for a long time. Was a big fan of what they were doing in propulsion systems and in trying to get into the suborbital industry, it was possible somebody could have come in there, maybe made the links happen. It's also possible somebody could have gone in there and did something with all the propulsion technologies. I think the fact that that didn't happen, I can't really say why that did or didn't happen. But I think your caller, your questioner there, was on to something that these things all have. These kind of situations have potential. There is value to be found in that, and I like to think that we often see some of that value, or a lot of that value.
So when it doesn't happen, you can't say that it means there's no value there. It just means that, for whatever combination of factors, nobody picked up on it, or nobody was able to pick up on it, or maybe management was so encumbered they couldn't do anything with it.
Well, there could be any number of reasons. I mean, sometimes things happen so fast that nobody can react in time. Or maybe there's nobody in a position to act in time. These things are often stories in and of themselves. When a company is close to or in trouble or is facing a lot of distress, so why somebody does or doesn't come in is its own story. I do know that when companies are in trouble, they do call a lot of people to try to save themselves. Why any of the people that they call don't do what they do, they all have their different reasons.
You have a caller on hold. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, it's Kyle in Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead.
I had some questions just about kind of the deep space industries acquisition. That's the most recent one, if I'm led to believe correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how it's all about both what they currently offer kind of as a company, but also what their future kind of possibilities are. And I guess the main thing that I understand is that there was a Comet propulsion system that was
mm-hmm.
acquired by Bradford.
Yeah.
And it's a water-based system, and that mixed with your Explorer kind of bus, satellite
mm-hmm.
bus, are you thinking that perhaps there would be a market opening up for kind of deep space missions by either government or private? Or, I mean, currently with, the monopropellants that we have in the Hall thrusters, it seems that there would be no need for a low ISP thrust based off of water, as it's a fairly dense fuel source. super low efficiency.
So you want to know if they see a market in propulsion that they acquired.
Right, right. So the, yeah, I guess to phrase the question a little bit better, I'm kind of
okay.
Rambling.
Ian, go ahead.
I'm glad you asked, because it actually lets me focus on Bradford rather than the, the broader acquisitions. The Bradford Space Group, which is composed of the three acquisitions, Bradford Engineering, the original, where the name comes from, in fact, then ECAPS, and then Deep Space Industries. Until we bought, even before we bought Deep Space Industries, Bradford actually had considerable activities in propulsion. It had propulsion in its Dutch operations in Bradford, and then it certainly had propulsion with an ECAPS. ECAPS, if you don't know what's behind ECAPS, it's a green, non-toxic, monoprop propulsion system based on a propellant. It's a propellant based on ammonium dinitramide, ADN. This is a replacement of hydrazine, and it actually offers lower ISP, higher than hydrazine, but lower than, say, electric propulsion, but high thrust, anywhere from 100 millinewtons right now we offer up to 200 newtons, but it could you could build the thrusters higher thrust than that. So we already been in the propulsion business in ECAPS, or the propulsion subsystems that we do at our Dutch site within original Bradford, quote-unquote, Bradford Engineering. But when we came to Deep Space Industries, they started as an asteroid mining company. They were famous for that. But they did some, very interesting things along the way from the time they got started as asteroid mining to, when we came to them. They were intelligent and bright enough to hire some very good people, some very good engineers, that put together some very interesting, products, one of which is the Comet water thruster. But they also put together things like the Explorer deep space bus. So when we came to Deep Space Industries, it was actually very interesting because there was the Comet, which fit in really well with our propulsion systems offerings. Our ECAPS also was non-toxic, high thrust, lower ISP, lower ISP than electric propulsion, but higher than hydrazine. The Comet was also like that. It's a little lower than hydrazine, the ISP, but the thrust, for a little satellite, a little microsat, to have even 17 millinewtons of thrust, that's actually really useful in a whole bunch of cases. So combine that with our 100 millinewton ECAPS thruster, it fit in really well into our lineup of chemical non-toxic propulsion. In fact, actually, since we added that to our lineup, I think we're pretty much now one of the world leaders, if not the world leader, in non-toxic chemical propulsion. But it fit in nicely, and we actually had quite a number of customers. There were customers before we came in, and customers since we've come in, who are interested in, not only the Comet, but the ECAPS. All the propulsion systems that we do. Now, that's what kind of brought us into there. But it's sometimes the thing you know, in the shop window, that lures you in, but when you come in, you find something that says that's really the value. I mean, the Deep Space Industries had been well on its way to putting together something that I think was very special, that a lot of people said that was really needed in the market, which is a lower cost. I say lower cost because things are always comparative in the space industry. A lower cost deep space mission bus, something that can go on a ride share and take itself to anywhere in the inner solar system, do what it needs to do, and come back. By the way, just for anyone who's nitpicky here, my definition of deep space is a little expansive. I consider everything beyond geostationary orbit to be deep space, so that includes the moon and Lagrange points, as well as, you know, Mars and Venus and near-Earth asteroids and all that stuff. But in any case, it's very interesting because that led to the next line of thought, that if we're already the world leader, or I hope we're the world leader, in non-toxic chemical propulsion, the kind of things that you need to get far and get fast, high thrust, with higher efficiency that you can, you know, manifest as a rideshare, then we have most of the things in-house, especially if you consider we have another business in attitude and orbit control. We have all the things in-house that you could actually make this kind of deep space mission bus happen. So anyways, I meandered along the way to get to this point. But the answer to your question is yes. Actually, we think that there is interest. I think there's going to be a lot of activity in deep space. Again, my definition that includes the moon and all those things. You look at all the companies that are looking to go to the moon, the NASA CLPS companies, that the nine companies there, but not just the nine. You have a whole bunch of CubeSats that are, you know, they're slated for EM-1 to go around the moon. Marco, of course, the CubeSats that went past Mars. But, you know, even if you don't just look at the missions that are being worked on, or the companies that are being worked on, there is quite a latent demand, I think, by the space agencies of the world, or really more specifically the principal investigators and the scientists of the world, that don't want to be spending much of their life or much of a decade, pitching $500 million programs and having a 10% chance of ever or less of ever doing anything that you propose. If you are bring down the cost, bring down the risk, make this implementable, yeah, I think there's a demand. So this is the thing that we got, I think. The propulsion, the comet propulsion, was the thing that brought us in the store. I think the Explorer is something quite interesting, and I think we've only just started to do things with that.
I see. It just seems that there is a need. I mean, I'm coming from an amateur here, but. But my question, I kind of an adjoining question to that is, do you really think that that these kind of government-based science programs might actually purchase from Bradford, or do you think that they just kind of single-headedly go down the road of, well, we're just going to do cost overruns here, and it doesn't matter. We're going to buy what we need, kind of from where we already always done it.
Well, I'm not in the heads of any of the people in the space agencies of the world. Maybe it's unbridled enthusiasm at the idea of doing missions. We have heard of a lot of people that this is something that should or could happen. And whether we sell a mission or partner on a mission or do a mission ourselves, I think the reality is a lot of these things are to be understood as we go forward. I think we have a strong business already. We have the good thing about the business, the company that we've put together, Bradford, is that it's strong. It has multiple product lines. It has multiple many customers over at least three continents, and if not more, and. It can pursue things like this, and I think if you have a good product and a good story, and customers willing to buy or participate or work with you, then that's the essence of business. Sitting here, I don't know if I can tell you we're going to have a mission next year, but I certainly loved the idea of it, and I think this is in many ways continuing the mission in a different sense of a company mission of Deep Space Industries. Wanted to do only. I think we can do it. I think we're doing it with, an infrastructure that can carry it further, or further than it ever could have by itself.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the responses. It certainly seems to me that. Could open up quite a bit of less expensive science missions for both, public and maybe private institutions, kind of university level. I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit too far yet, but
Listener, I did not get your name. Is it Kurt?
Kyle.
Kyle. Okay. Thank you for your call, Kyle. Appreciate it very much. Listeners, that opens up our toll-free line, and let me give you that number, 1-866-687-7223. Ian, we're absolutely at the break-even point, so great timing there. By God.
Already.
Time goes fast.
It does.
Kind of like you're flying on a new version Concorde, maybe. We're going to take our pause here. We seldom get a chance to pause directly at the halfway point. We'll be back in 3 minutes, everybody, so don't go anyplace. And email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do answer the phone during the break, and we'll talk to you and put you on hold, but it's 1-866-687-7223. So don't go anywhere and give us a call.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday evening Space Show program. We're talking to Ian Fichtenbaum about mergers and acquisitions in the space industry through Bradford Space. Ian, when I introduced you, I didn't really read your academic part, but I'm interested in how you got your experience, your knowledge, your know-how on how to do what you're doing today. So you are from Canada, and you attended McGill, and you studied electrical engineering as well as physics. Then you went on to the University of British Columbia and studied operations research. And then you went to ISU, and that was in the 2006 program. So, and from there, did you enter directly into the companies where you're at now? Did you work for other merger or financial institutions? How did you learn how to do what you're doing?
Well, I mean, some of it comes from reading a lot about the industry over many, many years. And I remember reading all the discussions on Usenet or on the web about space policy topics and space industry topics, but some of them from going back quite a while. But I really got into the industry. Yes, I went to ISU, which was a great experience. But I really got in the industry when I think I followed the path of many ambitious, I don't know what, when I moved from Montreal, which is my hometown, to New York, I guess I tell everyone I came to find my fortune, and I had either the illusions or the visions or maybe the delusions at the time that I was going to the center of finance to be involved in rockets and spacecraft and space stations. I came to New York in 2008, and I actually would say I got my break into, quote unquote, into the realm of finance and the satellite industry through working at a firm known as Near Earth, the founder of which, Hoyt Davidson, I believe you've had on your program.
Yeah, several times, uh-huh.
So I worked with them. I worked with Hoyt for almost 6 years. The job that I had there was supporting all sorts of activities involving helping companies do acquisitions, helping companies sell themselves, raising capital for companies. So it was really kind of an experience where I spent a lot of time learning. You know, the interesting thing is I ended up learning about a whole bunch of corners of the industry that I never paid any attention before. For instance, I never knew, even though I spent a lot of time reading about space policy, I never knew about all the people who made satellite antennas, for instance, or who operated teleports, or what the business models of those companies are, and how they make money or what they're valued. So it was a great learning experience of getting to know the whole industry from bottom to top and all the different parts of the value chain. And we spent a lot of time both in is traditional satellite, which is telecommunications or imaging, and in space. We worked with a number of, you know, entrepreneurial space companies, raised some capital, even did a little investing my own for a select couple of companies. And it was, I think, a great experience. I was with them for almost 6 years, as I said. I think at that point, you know, it was actually very interesting because that takes us about to 2014, which is really when a lot of capital started coming into the industry. I think if you look at the pattern of how many satellites were getting launched, at least, and, you know, venture capital rounds, it was 2014 where things really started going. After being with Near Earth, I didn't actually take the tack of doing venture capital. It was very interesting. AIAC, as I said, was, the product of our chairman, the founder of AIAC, a rather brilliant man who was put together, this very large industrial empire just by, buying companies left, right, and center. I had the fortune of having to meet him, almost in the serendipitous way. He already owned quite a number of aerospace companies. He loved aerospace. He had bought, actually, units of Boeing and Lockheed and a number of other aerospace companies before. So the idea that, we knew a lot of the companies out there in the space industry, he was very interested. So when doing what I was doing with Near Earth, I thought it would be very interesting to be the person doing the buying. And that's exactly what we wanted to do at AIAC. It was sort of like I came to him, to the chairman, and said, let's go buy some space companies. And let's look for them under look for them in every corner and every crevice and, see what you can find of interesting. And this would be a whole another hour and a half program if we were to tell you, some of the stories of things that we tried to buy. Fortunately, we don't really have the time. But it wasn't until late 2016 where we found, I think, a very beautiful company, really, which was Bradford Engineering in the Netherlands. And that got us started to build the current group, which is a manufacturer of space systems. We could have ended up being in the ground systems business. We could have been in the rocket business. We didn't end up getting it, but doesn't mean we can't go into it in the future. I think we've gotten off to a good start in AIAC of building the Bradford Group. It's really something that we're proud of, and I'm personally very proud to have had a very role that I've had in building it so far. And
are you hiring new people? Do you look for potential new ENs down the road?
We're very open for opportunities. I mean, the strength of our group is that you bring us ideas. We are very happy to have you part of the growth. And growth can mean acquisition of new companies or building the companies that we have. we have very good employees and management at all of our companies, either because they were there when we acquired the company or we brought them in after the fact. And I mean, you can't build a company. You can't build a successful company. I don't think you can build a company without good employees, people who are excited about the things that you're doing, things that people are good at what you make or what you do. So I think this is kind of a, maybe it's a cop-out answer because it doesn't say anything specific, but we always love having
Barry,
people bringing
you
us.
Said listen to the space show while
I've got another caller on hold, so who violated our cardinal rule of talking before we bring him into the show.
But
go ahead, finish your thought, and then I'll bring in our caller.
I had no bigger thought than we always want people to either bring us opportunities for acquisition, opportunities where we can sell our product, opportunities where we can build a new line of business or extend a line of business. I think we wouldn't be good business people if we turned those opportunities away.
Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall, and I'm all the way down in Yukon, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Ooh.
I went to the big city today.
Oh.
So what's on your mind, Marshall?
I was thinking about the old, I think it was called Iridium, satellite phone system. And as I recall, it went bankrupt and got reorganized, and they are actually sending up new modules to replace the old ones and so on. So it's an ongoing business that keeps going on, and it's kind of like there's hundreds of little companies that are contributing to it, and it's, you know, slowly establishing itself. Is this the way a lot of the smaller companies are working?
I'm not sure if I fully understand your question. I think you brought up a very, very intensely interesting topic to me, because the whole history of the building and the first collapse and the rescue and the rebuilding of Iridium is a fascinating topic to me. In fact, there was a great book written quite recently about that whole topic, about that whole history, called Eccentric Orbits, which if anyone is ever interested in doing acquisitions or grand acquisitions of troubled assets in the space industry, that book is probably required reading, and you'll see what it sometimes takes to put together the pieces of a deal in a situation like that. I think I just love referencing that that particular history because it is so fascinating. And just from the history and what they, I mean, the beauty of the system that they salvaged. I think there's just something exciting about rescuing a global network of satellites. You know, speaking of Iridium itself, it's actually done pretty well. You've mentioned that they have been launching new satellites. In fact, they just finished launching all their new satellites. And the new constellation has been coming online. Actually, I think it's probably online. Some companies, some businesses are, some industries, in fact, are, to build them is a process. A lot of things get started. A lot of things fail. Sometimes somebody picks up the pieces of the things that fail. Sometimes there's just somebody who succeeds very well without failing. Industries grow through a lot of steps that are not obvious.
Yeah, it takes a whole bunch of geniuses to get some of this to work, and just because you're a genius doesn't mean you're always right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The really good ideas eventually do work themselves out, and that's the optimistic point.
Yeah, and actually looking at a lot of the failures in the industry, and several years ago I actually did a survey of a lot of historical space satellite companies, many of which who failed or failed at the time, and even the ones that failed, usually there was something that came out of it. Usually something that was learned, or some infrastructure that was reused, or technology that got transferred or inspired something else. So there's rarely total waste of effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's basically one of the we talk about the fallouts from the Apollo program. The private industry has fallout also.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, it's time for me to let somebody else talk.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Thank you.
So, listeners, the toll-free line is once again available if you would like to use it, 1-866-687-7223. Carolyn is in Seattle with a question, and she said, I'm curious if you are now or will be doing things using cryptocurrency, which I hear is very popular in some aspects of investment and corporate finance.
I'm personally interested. I don't conduct most of my activities in the sector. I think it's its own separate sector with quite a lot of interesting aspects. I think it's a little beyond the scope of this show to talk about them, but I'm actually pretty positive about the sector and both in the medium and the long run. Actually, and hard to say in what run it is, because a lot of things change in it very fast. As a group, we don't spend a lot of time on it. I do spend some time on it personally.
Okay, so that's a question. I have another listener from James in Tucson, Arizona, and he said, have you looked at any opportunities, or are there any money-making opportunities for human spaceflight?
There are companies who make a great business selling services to the government. I mean, there are private equity firms that focus on buying government contractors and operating them. Some of which operate the facilities in Houston or in Huntsville or in Florida or wherever they are. It's not a simple question, because there are businesses of all sorts out there, and some of them are government contractors serving the existing markets. Now, is there human space flight potential out there? Well, look at it. There's a number of companies already doing it. SpaceX and Boeing, of course. Sierra Nevada would be doing it if they were doing a crew Dream Chaser. There are some companies that do life systems for spacecraft. Is it a big sector right now? Not yet. Actually, I should mention that Bradford is also in the human space flight business. In addition to the propulsion systems and the attitude control and the deep space missions, we have a product line which we prominently display that is sort of in the category of space station facilities. Actually, we have a name for it. It's called Bradford Workspaces. And this is based on actually one of our oldest product lines, which was the glove boxes. The glove boxes maybe is one of the, you know, the way I describe it to anyone who I see, you know, in daily life about what we build, I said, you know, you ever seen the astronauts, you know, the pictures of the astronauts, they're putting their hands in the glass box whenever they're doing experiments. That's a glove box. We built that. Actually, Bradford built all the ones on the space station, at least all the ones I know about, the microgravity science glove box and the life science glove box. And we're very proud of the things that we've built. The life science glove box is actually a very impressive large facility that was installed last year. And we're actually pretty excited about the idea that, so these glove boxes, or workspaces as we're starting to call them, they're containment systems. They're containment systems in space. And right now we use them for science and other physical experiments or pretty much anything related to that. And the reason why we use it for that is because these are government space stations. So people, you know, the governments of the world have built them to do science, to, you know, to show that we're doing something to explore the frontier. But in a world where you have private and commercial space stations, it's kind of like if you only ever built battleships or naval ships before, like if that's the only ship that you ever built, and then somebody decides we're going to start building yachts and cruise ships, ships for pleasure or for leisure or other various reasons. I mean, you wouldn't put like the same systems that you put in a naval ship in a cruise ship. I mean, not all of them. I mean, some of them obviously propulsion and such, but the systems are different. So we're very intrigued by the idea that the containment systems, the glove boxes that we've built for government space stations could be used in interesting ways for private space stations. I have a quote-unquote pet idea that, we might be able to bring people's pets up to space with our glove boxes. Don't have a full design on that yet, but there's creative things that we do. Actually, it's a great opportunity if anyone's listening who has an interesting idea of what we can do with our glove boxes. This is something we're very excited about doing, and this is about human space flight. And this is a business that we want to do within Bradford. It was a long way of saying yes.
Very long way, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Do you see in the commercial space world or in the world of space operations that you're looking at, do you see or spot any trends that are developing or have developed that will go with us for a while into the future?
There's a lot of, in trends, I think there's a developing infrastructure. That more than anything is a trend. There is a more robust infrastructure for launch. There is more robust infrastructure insofar as that there is a space station and there are regular cargo missions. There is a bit more of an infrastructure on the supply chain. There are a lot more people who are focusing on building components for small satellites. Supply chain is actually a really interesting topic because I think a fragile supply chain is what keeps the industry, holds it back. And a maturing of the supply chain, maturing of the infrastructure is going to, in my opinion, allow people to access space at lower cost, at lower lead times, greater accessibility, greater affordability. So that's a general trend that I like. It's a general trend that I think I'd like to think that we're capturing by getting into the space industry. especially on the component level. And that more than anything is I think what the bet is. It's a maturing infrastructure that lets the world or the economy do more and more things in space, which means more things in space.
We do a lot of shows where people want to have a business or are going to develop a business where they claim they're helping to develop cislunar infrastructure or something of that nature. Whether they're doing that yet or not, I'm not able to answer, but I know that's a goal of a lot of companies.
Well, I view infrastructure in a more detailed way than merely... I understand the people who want to put depots and have fueling stations or transfer vehicles in cislunar orbit, but I'm more simple, more terrestrial focused. Infrastructure, sometimes in my head is mind, is the idea that you can order a thruster or 50 thrusters and be able to get it, have it delivered in 6 to 8 months or less, or any of the pieces of a spacecraft, from the solar panels to the power systems to the avionics to the all the things that you actually need in order to build a spacecraft, all the complications that it takes to do that. And one of the things that I think not enough attention has been on, has been paid, is improving the robustness of the economy, the manufacturing economy, the operational economy of getting things into space. Actually, forget about getting things into space, just moving spacecraft on the ground from where you manufacture it to the launch site. Simplifying the logistics of that, simplifying the logistics of fueling the spacecraft, simplifying the logistics of procuring, the parts and the subsystems. So I know the people, and I know the efforts to improve the infrastructure of cislunar space. I also believe very much that we need to improve the infrastructure of operations and manufacturing. On the ground, and if you do that, and it is something that will get improved as demand increases. It feeds on itself slowly but surely. Then you will have a more robust space economy and infrastructure.
You have another email from Sherry. Sherry's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And she says, do you get involved with the national security and the defense side of the industry? And do you believe that our hardware in space and what we're doing is at risk because of national security problems with other countries, specifically China?
We do get involved. We do provide systems on the subsystem level and systems to defense projects. Sometimes we're doing it as a supplier to others. Sometimes we're a little more direct or providing a subsystem. Most of the times we're not building a whole spacecraft, so we're not interfacing usually with the defense customer. But we know... and we understand some of the markets around that. We actually care very deeply about the accessibility of space. We believe very strongly that if you're doing something in space, you should not be doing it in a way that creates harm to others or reduces accessibility to others. Or act in aggressive ways in space, because that's, I think, against I think our vision of how space is going to develop. A lot of people get into the space industry because they want to open up the space economy. They want to be able to access the resources. So we do believe that there's a lot of opportunity. But a lot of people don't want to do the dual use aspects of space. So we're actually quite careful about it, that we do avoid it ourselves, try to stay focused on the non-aggressive parts of space. That doesn't mean that we don't work with security. I just said we do. But I think it's going to be, this is a question a lot of people, a lot of companies have to ask themselves how they want to participate in it. You know, in terms of other countries, actually that is probably the most significant question, because you want them to get the message of that they should act in the same way in space, to act non-aggressively, to not limit the accessibility to others. So I think there is a standard of activity that needs to be set. I don't know if that's set at the government level or companies just acting in a way to promote just the general peaceful uses of space. We can't have low Earth orbit filled with debris because people are shooting at other, one nation shooting at another nation's satellites. It just ruins the accessibility of space to all.
Yeah, it's already filled with debris. So.
Yeah.
Which reminds me that I interview quite a few companies who believe they are on the path to solving LEO debris problem. I'm assuming you have your eyes on that type of industry. Am I correct in that assumption?
Well, we actually supply some of our thrusters, the ECAPS thrusters, to one debris removal company, Astroscale. The Japanese-Singaporean debris removal company will be using some of our thrusters.
They were just on the show a week ago.
Oh, that's right.
From Japan. I had now I'm having a senior moment. I don't remember his name, but it used to be at NASA headquarters here, and then NASA liaison in Singapore and in Japan, and now he's over there with the company. Darn, I can't think of his name. I'm embarrassed.
Yeah. You know, this is a situation where, you know, our ECAPS thrusters were high performance they were appropriate performance. They're high performance, but they were a good fit for the use case of, you know, the Astroscale spacecraft on their own. I mean, even without any reference to whether it's hydrazine or not hydrazine, but I think there was a certain cherry on top argument that, you know, this is a spacecraft used to clean the debris in orbit. It would be really good for it to be also non-toxic propellant that it uses. So that's a particular project that we're pretty proud of.
Listeners, there is still time. If you would like to give us a call, it is 1-866-687-7223. And let me take a quick minute to thank our second segment sponsors, which I have not done yet. So the Space Development Network says that if you would like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime, you should join this free online organization that allows you to work together with others to advocate space development and the plans for that, and they're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. Again, it's free to join, and you can find out more at developspace.info. And the Integrated Space Plan is our sponsor. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a space-faring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. You can explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website, thespaceplan, all one word, .com, and check it out. And you can buy copies of the Space Plan as well, too. And then, in addition, Celestis is our sponsor. And remember, they are still the only provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. And they launch from different locations, suborbital out of New Mexico, orbital out of the Cape, Vandenberg. They're soon going to be going to the moon and hopefully deep space and on to Mars. It is a great way to pay tribute to your loved one. And you can add your DNA with the DNA or ashes of your loved one and make the symbolic ride with them. And they're a great company, and it is Celestis.com, and I am their customer, so I'm disclosing that. I've done 3 flights with my mom and my dog, my 2 dogs, and they really are truly an outstanding company. And then the National Space Society is a sponsor. They have ISDC coming up just around the corner in June. I will be there. It's in Alexandria, Virginia. You can get to their website and learn all about it at nss.org, and then just click on the big ISDC information on their homepage. And we do thank all of our sponsors. And once again, email is drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And again, still time for a phone call, 1-866-687-7223. Does Bradford have any plans to become public at some point?
I'm having so much fun being part of Bradford, the ownership and the leadership of it. I don't know if it's anything I'm thinking about right now. Let's grow Bradford a little bit and then you come back to us.
By the way, the Astrospace gentleman that was on the show was Chris Blackerby. You probably know him.
I've met him, yes.
Yeah, so you're one up than I have. I've talked to him but have not yet met him. Yeah. That was a fascinating show, and so you're on their upcoming demo flight with thrusters in.
Yes, I think 8 thrusters, 8 1-Newton thrusters.
Yeah, he talked quite a bit about that upcoming flight on our show. What should we have talked about that we have omitted or that I didn't even know enough to ask you or that you would like to say, because we're coming down into the last few minutes of the program? What have we missed?
I'm not sure. I'm after the show, I'm going to say, oh, I should have talked about this. I just want to underline it. Businesses are built on good customers and products and a lot of hard work and sales and attention to detail and operations. And I like to think that we have that. We have within Bradford, we have a beautiful group. We have beautiful facilities in the Netherlands and Sweden, now in California. We're trying to build out a presence in Luxembourg as well. I think we're going to have a lot of interesting products, both for the current space industry, but also for the deep space industry. I think we like the opportunity of doing things for deep space missions, for deep space missions, possibly our own deep space missions. I think we have great infrastructure to do it. I mean, I can't believe I didn't mention this, but Bradford is responsible for putting over 2,000 of its products into space. Over 2,000 Bradford products have been to space so far. That's in the whole history of the 3 parts of Bradford. This is a group that comes from an expertise in manufacturing quality products for space systems, space missions, and I'm excited that we have this capability because I think we can do some pretty cool stuff with it.
Where are you in California?
In San Jose.
Okay. So you have offices in San Jose. Where are your corporate offices, your global headquarters?
Well, I'm based in New York, so I'm the oddball of it. But it's actually quite convenient to oversee all the different parts, especially one part in California and a bunch of parts in Europe. The biggest part, the largest operations is in the Netherlands. That's about 45 employees in three buildings on a little site in the south of the Netherlands near the Belgian border. The next biggest is the Swedish operations. That's in Solna. That's a suburb of Stockholm. And that's where we do all of our ECAPs, propulsion systems, manufacturing, development and manufacturing. We do have a test fire facility south of Stockholm in Grindgården, if I pronounced that right. That's on the site of the Swedish Defense Research Agency. And then I think the facility after that in terms of size is in San Jose. That is actually the old Deep Space Industries. That is, you know, where they were operating, and much of the team is there working on either the Comet water-based propulsion system there, or the Deep Space missions, or some of the other propulsion systems that we have there, and actually including a biprop, a green biprop system that we have there. And some other things. And then I think the one that's more nascent, but we do actually have a presence, is in Luxembourg, where we, you know, they've been doing a lot of things there, as you know, and we're actually quite keen to be part of it. And I think actually it's actually a presence that was inherited from Deep Space Industries, but now that it's actually you know, much closer to, well, it's certainly a 3-hour drive from our Dutch facilities. So it's something that we can develop with all the support that we already have in Europe.
Do you have an acquisition that you're working on that you can tell us, or?
Well, the answer to that question, in its full terms is no. We don't talk about acquisitions until they're done. The limited answer is we're always looking at things. We always have some things in the works. We do have ambitions to be larger and more significant. And that's all I can really say.
I got one final email that came in 11th hour. Alex is in Chicago. And he said, I'm simply curious, is it easier to do an acquisition in the United States or a foreign country like the Netherlands or Japan or someplace else in Europe?
So much of our experience is usually in, you know, North America, and that actually includes U.S., Canada, and Mexico, which is pretty much North America, and a lot of Western Europe. It's easier to do acquisitions where you have well-defined rules, well-defined legal systems, you know, large communities of lawyers and accountants, and a tradition of standard accounting practices. That you can understand and follow. It helps if financial statements are in languages that we can read, or easily translatable into things that we can read, because it helps be able to understand the business and be able to talk to the business and the companies when you go into them. You know, the farther they are to travel to, the harder it is to, you know, implement and oversee. That might be one of the reasons why, at least in my area of activity, I haven't gone to look at anything in Asia or in Australia yet, just because it's just so far to travel to, and the time zones are so wildly different. But actually, within a larger group within AIC, we do have things in quite a substantial number of companies in Asia. It's being able to operate in a place where there are lots of professional services and understandable accounting. It's so important to have understandable accounting, accounting you can trust, accounting that you can analyze. That just makes acquisitions so much easier. And that's one of the major differences. I mean, country to country, there are cultural differences. There are differences in the legal process to acquire. I mean, if you're not afraid to venture out of the U.S., then you can get yourself familiar with all these things. It's not that hard to go find to get a relationship with a good lawyer and a good banker and a good accountant in the Netherlands or Sweden or France or the UK or Germany some of the other developed countries and go out and do acquisitions. The real difference is some of the particulars and probably the travel and the time zones.
Anything else you would like to add tonight before we sign off?
Go check out our website. Go see if you need some propulsion systems or attitude control systems or have ideas for our glove boxes or really want to partner with us on a deep space mission. We're raring to do a lot of things. We love to hear the ideas or the interest or the we're certainly interested in having customers, but also work with as many people as possible to implement their space visions or markets or products, whatever they are.
And your website is bradford-space.com, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right, indeed.
Ian, we will stay in touch and follow you and hope to talk to you again down the road. And it's been most interesting. So thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It was an interesting opportunity. I never really had been able. I never did a show like this, and I'm sure we will be in touch and hear from each other more in the future.
I look forward to it. And listeners, we have a Friday program and a Sunday program. There is no Hotel Mars this week, for me at least. And keep looking up, everybody. And good night from Ian, David, and the Space Show. Keep it safe.